Hi there, and welcome to Brave. This is the podcast about the people, companies, and ideas that are contributing to a better future. I'm your host, Bethan Vincent. I am the managing partner of Open Velocity. We're a marketing strategy consultancy, but I set up the Brave way before I even set up OV as a business back in 2019. And honestly, it was a bit of an excuse for me to go and speak to interesting people doing interesting things. I'm one of those kind of super curious people who likes to learn, you know, what's happening outside of my own kind of worldview, my own discipline. And in each episode, we speak to scientists, founders, CEOs, leaders, or just kind of everyday people doing something really cool. And we talk about what it takes to build new products, create new markets, and generally challenge the status quo. And this thread of challenging the status quo weaves throughout each episode, because we know as a society, as a global population, we live in an age of perma-crisis, I guess you could say. You know, there's a lot of challenges we face in the world, from structural inequality to the climate crisis to stagnant economic growth or having equitable economic growth. And in this podcast, we try and kind of speak to the people coming up with solutions. And those solutions can be, you know, they're a startup, they're kind of building something new, they can be a leader in an organization doing something a little bit differently, or they can be a private citizen who is just taking a different approach to the world. And really, you know, I want people to kind of come away from this podcast feeling kind of that there are solutions to these problems, because there definitely are. And today we have a really interesting guest on the show. I mean, I say it about every guest that they're super interesting, and that is 100% true. But the guest we have today comes with a lot of experience, an amazing professional pedigree. So today we're speaking to Sarah Mukherjee, who is the CEO of AEMA, and previously was the BBC's environment correspondent. So Sarah was presenting on national, international, radio, television, winning awards across the world. And AEMA is the professional body for everyone working in environment and sustainability. And it works to drive understanding and uptake of the crucial skills that we are going to need to make businesses, organisations future-proof. So, right, perfect fit for this podcast. And in this episode with Sarah, we kind of explore, you know, sustainable skills as a concept. You know, what the hell are sustainable skills? You know, why do I need them in my business? What's the importance of having them? What are they going to do for me? We also talk about kind of long-term thinking as well. What are the kind of horizons we need to think to in businesses to create change? We also touch on that old topic of actually, how do you create change? Because change is really, really hard. And that's that whole challenging the status quo piece coming through. And we also talk about, you know, how do you make business decisions with sustainability in mind? And what do we actually mean by sustainability? Which is a pretty foundational question I think a lot of people brush over, if I'm honest. So, as always, I really hope you enjoy this episode. Sarah is a fantastic guest, and we will put all the links and everything we've explored, as usual, down in the show notes if you want to explore more. Brilliant. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yes, it's a total pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me. What an honour.
Brilliant. Could you kick off with a little bit of explanation about you, your experience, because it's vast, and AEMA as well, if people haven't come across it before, who AEMA is, what you guys do?
Sure. So I have been kicking around this space for a long time, so long I don't say it because it just sounds, makes me feel very, very old and sound quite old. But started off, I guess, as the BBC's environment correspondent for many years, which was a fantastic job. I was very grateful and blessed to be able to do that. And it just allowed me as well to interrogate a lot of the different areas. And when you think, well, we say environment or sustainability, we're talking about pretty much every sector of the UK economy, plus things like the wildlife charities, biodiversity, farming, food. So it's so huge that I really had a very wide brief to look at some really interesting stories across those pieces, often quite counterintuitive, you know, things that you thought would be a good intervention sometimes weren't or had an unintended consequences, as we often find in an environment. Left the BBC for various reasons in 2011, I think it was, then moved into the water industry, And then moved into some leadership roles in agriculture, and then joined IEMA in the middle of lockdown in 2020. So really didn't meet the staff team face to face for about 18 months it took us.
I think a lot of people had that experience, didn't they, where they started jobs and they were like, right, I've never met anyone in person.
No, it was, and we just, the first face-to-face staff meeting we had was just, we just basically said, right, just here's tea and coffee and lunch, just talk. And it was great because it was, you know, you could almost feel the kind of river overflowing with all the conversations that people wanted to have. So IEMA is the professional institute for anybody interested in sustainability or the environment. We have 22,000 members in more than 100 countries. And as the previous sort of thoughts would suggest, they cover pretty much every sector of the UK and global economy. Construction, transport, procurement, comms, HR. I mean, one of our mantras is that all jobs need to be greener, and we can talk a little bit about that later on. But certainly our view is that if we are going to get to the place we need to get to, at the speed at which we need to get to, everybody in an organisation needs to understand what their role is in order to move to that more sustainable business environment. I mean, for example, you would expect when you joined an organisation to have a health and safety briefing. You'd expect to have an HR briefing. We would say, well, we'd also expect you to have a sustainability briefing as well, and some training around that, as you would do, you know, to stop, you know, to support your IT and cybersecurity. It's as important for you to understand what your role is in the sustainable future.
That's really interesting. And I want to dig into something you said about how sustainability is all-encompassing, because it's a word that has been used so many times that it's kind of lost a little bit of meaning. And obviously, you know, we see companies claim they are sustainable where they're potentially greenwashing. So what does sustainability actually mean? That seems like a really silly question, but I think it's an important one.
It's a really, really good question, because I think you're right. Everybody has a slightly different view. It's a bit like resilience. When I worked in water, then we had endless conversations about what resilience meant. And there's lots of definitions, like there are with sustainability. So there are the sustainability goals, which gives you quite clear definitions of what sustainability means. I would say, from a personal point of view, it's leaving the planet in a better state than when you left it. So, because I think that for me encompasses all the different bits of sustainability. Also, I mean, having said that, increasingly with our, and in fact, interestingly, just as an aside, we're having quite a long process with our members talking about, well, what should we be looking like as an organisation in 20 years' time? Is what we call sustainability now fit for the future? And increasingly, sustainability experts within organisations encompass human rights. They encompass what we're terming social sustainability as well. So are you, as an organisation, leaving the area in which you work, where your office is based, are you giving back to that space? Are you supporting skills and training in your local FE college or school? Are you doing charity work or voluntary work or environmental supporting work within that footprint? Are you an active and good corporate citizen? Which becomes really important, I think, for many people, particularly if they've chosen a sustainable path, and also because they want to work for values-driven organisations. And increasingly, we're finding, particularly for young, early yeah. career professionals, under 35, under 30, they want to join an organisation that they feel is doing good and not just talking about it.
And there's also this focus on sustainable skills as well, and embedding those in organisations. And again, it's a bit of a like, what is this question? Because, you know, as someone who runs a business, and I know a lot of our listeners are either running or on leadership teams of businesses in various different sectors, you're sat there thinking that, yes, sustainability seems like something we should be doing, but what do we need in the business to do it?
Yes. Well, of course, I would say, wouldn't I? We have 350 courses, of which, you know, get all sorts of levels. And we have something that's been really successful and popular, and something, a course that we've developed fairly recently, and every IEMA member, every new starter goes on this course, 5-day course called the Foundation Certificate, and you become an associate AIEMA, IEMA, at the end, so you get letters after your name. And it really walks you through history of climate change, what the carbon cycle is, what other cycles are, phosphorus cycles, nitrogen cycles, how what everything we're doing is making some sort of impact on the planet, and also the trade-offs that we currently have at the moment between, say, food and farming and transportation and land use, and the changes that you see from a policy point of view, how that affects our everyday lives and how it's affecting the planet as well. And so in terms of sustainability skills, it's almost that, and it's interesting, isn't it? You're absolutely right, Beth. And people, I mean, lots of organizations are thinking, well, what does sustainability skills mean? But we wouldn't be asking ourselves, well, what does finance mean? Do we need people who understand finance in order to run an organization? And should it just be the finance people who understand? No, probably not, because if you've got to balance a budget, then you really have to have an understanding of how you do that wherever you are in an organization. And in the same way, we're trying to balance our planetary budget as well. So I would say, yes, every time you make a decision, wherever you sit in an organization, the ability to think, okay, so what's the impact on the planet? What's the impact on our organization? And often, if you reduce your organizational impact, you're reducing your financial impact in the long term, or indeed in the short term as well.
So the incentive isn't just altruistic, it's actually, there's a material kind of business imperative to do this. And I wonder if, because you have a long history in this space, the organization has a long history in this space, do you get a sense we're at a kind of tipping point of people's both interest and appetite to look at sustainability? Because obviously, you know, in wider kind of public discourse, it really seems to be the climate crisis is on people's minds. But that, does that change translate through into businesses as well?
It does, certainly from our experience. And in fact, it's the more optimistic end, I would say, of the conversations that we have. So we are UNFCCC accredited observers. So we have the right to go to the COP process, to see the COP talks every year and take part in the COP talks and listen to negotiations and be part of that process. We think about it very hard every year because we're using carbon to do it, but we have members all over the world, and it's much more efficient to meet them in one place than it is to travel around to see people. But we do think about it. And I have to say, you know, if you sit in the negotiations, as I've done for hours at a time, days at a time, sometimes it does really kind of begin to erode your soul sometimes, because you feel that there's so much talking going on and so little actual action. And the people who want to see the action are so passionate about it. And yet, because you have consensus, it's a consensus process, so everybody has to agree with whatever decision is made, it moves so slowly, although better than nothing, I think you could probably agree. You know, if we didn't have that, it would be a bit of a free-for-all. But the people you meet, the young people around the world who are just saying, do you know what, we can't wait for this to happen, for governments to do this, we need to take action, and businesses as well. I think businesses get it, because if you have a supply chain anywhere outside your own territorial boundaries, you are going to know that things are changing in a way that we are finding increasingly difficult to predict. I mean, for example, I was talking to one of the Omani delegation, really very interesting. They run the Outward Bound charity in Oman, and they were saying that there are villages that simply don't have sewerage systems because it only ever rained maybe twice a year, now underwater because it's raining very, very regularly. You're getting tropical cyclones beginning to move into Oman in a way that never happened before. If you think, well, if you're getting raw materials from a region like that, or if you're a food company and you're getting coffee and cocoa from particular areas which are getting very fragile now, that really concentrates your minds in terms of action you have to take as an organisation to ensure that sustainability.
And that it does engender long-term thinking as well, which I think is something that organisations, I'm not pointing any kind of individual fingers here, but I think it's fair to say, especially corporate organisations have been very short-termist. You can even say governments are, especially in this country, to some certain degree. But do you think, again, that kind of long-term focus, people are now realising, like the examples you've given, oh, in 10 years, we're not going to have the same volume of grapes, for example, in the wine industry. And that's going to be a huge issue for us. What do we do about it now?
Yeah, yes, I really do think that is happening. And as using grapes as an example, so there are, I was speaking to a wine expert recently, actually, who said that there are, you know, there are real issues in some very traditionally very, very big wine producing areas in France, for example, where you've had consecutive summers that are much hotter than you would expect. There are issues with volume, there are issues with quality, there's issues with the fragility or sustained resilience of the vines themselves. That has brought some opportunities to places in England which have very similar geology, and where increasingly you're seeing wine producers looking to produce those exceptional wines that used to be a matter of course in regions in France. But also, you can't predict it. This is, I was talking recently to a reinsurer who mentioned, and I think it was probably one of those things that I might have flicked through on my phone on the news, but $3 billion Euro event, a hail event, hailstorm event in Italy, which cost 3 billion euros in terms of the damage that it did. Now, that is, that didn't even make the headlines really in the UK, as far as I was aware. I mean, I thought, oh, yes, yes, I do. Now you say it, I do remember it. But if you're thinking of those things that are happening all the time in very unpredictable ways, any business that has that sees a future for itself, which is all businesses, has to think quite seriously about, okay, so how are we going to supply this stuff? How are we going to source this stuff in the future when it's a very unpredictable future we're looking at? Well, one way of mitigating that unpredictability is by reducing our greenhouse gases as per all the scientific or vast, vast bulk of the majority of scientific evidence would suggest.
And that requires change. And change, you know, again, is notoriously, especially at an organisational level, difficult to achieve. So, you know, let's say you have embedded the skills side, the kind of hard skills, we'll call them, to affect kind of change. Is there a kind of, I guess that there's a cultural element within an organisation that also needs to change alongside the kind of knowledge aspect of things? Is that correct?
Totally, absolutely. And the culture, as anybody who's trying to do a cultural change in an organisation will know, it's always, you know, you can stick in as many processes as you like. The culture is always the thing that's really the difficult thing to change, because culture gets embedded very quickly. And can be very, very long lasting and very resistant to change. So that, oh, we've always done it like that. I mean, we've all had a conversation at some point in our career with, well, that's just how we've always done it. And I'm quite used to, I'm happy with that. I know what that means now, that process, and I don't really want to change it. So you can't do this just by the C-suite. I mean, often I talk to members of the corporate world who, you know, whose boss has been to Davos or had lunch with Al Gore or something, and they come back and say, yes, let's do sustainability. And there's some massive blitz for about 7 weeks, 8 weeks of, yeah. You know, let's have lots of meetings and workshops and staff meetings and away days, and then it stops. And nobody's actually, you've had a little tiny bit of change. But maybe the C-suite are invested in this, but senior or middle managers say, well, hang on a second, you've asked me, this is yet another of the huge menu of things I'm being asked to do, as well as increase productivity, reduce headcount, cut costs, you've told me I need to do this, but I don't really feel that you've given me the tools with which to make those decisions. And so often you will see there's a bit of a sticky middle, if you like, within an organization where people quite understandably are resistant because they haven't been empowered or given the tools that they need to make that change. And that's where, to your point, the skills and training has to come.
That's really interesting, because then I guess, you know, to your point earlier about there's a kind of younger cohort now moving through, you probably have pressure from the bottom as well of people kind of being like, I want to work for an organisation that isn't actively damaging the planet, please. And then you have this top-down pressure and, like you say, this kind of layer in the middle. One of our previous episodes, we were talking about the personal things we can do to kind of make a positive impact from a sustainability perspective in our personal lives. And one of the points that was made in that is time is the biggest asset here, because time allows you to make choices. And it feels like that's the same within organisations as well. So is it a case of creating time for these initiatives, or is that too reductive?
I think it's time and repetition and a good case. You know, how is this? It's very easy to sit as a C-suite senior manager and say, well, of course, this is the right thing to do. But how are you actually going to walk people through the processes as well? And to your point about from the bottom up, you're absolutely right. I mean, we have lucky to have some brilliant early career professionals as part of IEMA, part of our futures group. And I remember a couple of years ago, one colleague showing me their LinkedIn profile, and it was just basically begging letters from recruiters saying, you know, you've got these sustainability skills, would you like to work here, would you like to work there? And their view very much was, well, I'm only going to work with someone I feel shares my values, and if you don't, then you're not going to get more than 6 months. I'll go before the probation period is over and find somewhere I feel more comfortable with, because you've got the power to do this at the moment. I mean, that's the thing we haven't spoken about, really, the kind of talent war for sustainability skills, which we hear a huge amount from the C-suite, is that, you know, there's everybody's looking for these same skills. They're incredibly important when you have them. So how do you nurture that talent, and how do you make sure that you're not just issuing orders, that there is a, you have to keep coming back to it and keep coming back, and make sure that it's part of the fibre of the organisation and not just a kind of umbrella that you put over every so often when it looks a bit, oh, it's raining or it's COP or it's something, put the umbrella up and let's talk a little bit about it. Every process has to be thought about through a sustainability lens, as well as the financial, health and safety, productivity. It's a filter you need to put into every business decision, as you would do all the other basic foundational filters that you would immediately, you know, just assume would be there as well.
Yeah, I know it's even kind of marketing's very kind of potentially could be very removed from this conversation, but it's even filtering into things like decisions around which websites to host do we go with. Oh, this is the one that's 100% renewable energy, they're doing carbon offsetting, all of that kind of stuff.
Yes, and also marketing, there will be increasingly large parts of your segmentation that will be whether you're B2B or B2C, that will be looking to a sustainability narrative that is meaningful and not just, oh, well, we've signed up to a few initiatives and ticked a few boxes. And what story do you really have to tell as an organisation to attract whatever it is you're looking for, new members of your staff team, new customers, new suppliers, new collaborators? There's a couple of regulatory devices, TCFD and TNFD, which are climate-related disclosures and nature-based disclosures as well. And certainly TCFD is now mandatory in increasingly large parts of the UK economy. Other countries like Brazil, Singapore, the EU, New Zealand are about to put this into mandatory regulatory space. And you as an organisation have to sometimes literally on the same page show your financial risks and your climate risks at the same time. Now, this really concentrates the mind. And in fact, I was speaking to a director of sustainability of a very, very big retailer in the UK recently who said, I don't think anybody realises just how radical this is as a move. Because once investors start seeing those pieces of information together, that's a very powerful driver. And so you can't ignore this or assume someone else is going to do it for you.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to the kind of step change we were discussing, or the kind of exponential increasing kind of focus on this, because I had a startup 10 years ago, God bloody hell, now, which was an ethical certification. And for various reasons, it didn't work out. But one of the challenges back in kind of 2015 was that consumers basically said they would prefer to buy sustainable items, but that didn't actually follow through in the purchase decisions. And it's interesting that when you look at the data now, that has flipped. Or they still care about sustainability and now they will purchase based on that. It's not just kind of, oh, I'd like to feel good and think that I'll do this.
Well, yes, because if you're thinking, and you know, we can't ignore a cost of living crisis where there are people who are really struggling, whether they're putting food on the table or trying to heat your home or whatever it is. But I think actually that speaks to a more sustainability-driven agenda as well, because if you're going to make a purchase, you're probably inevitably, we all are doing it much less. We're buying much less stuff, but we want it to feel more meaningful. So if you've got a limited amount of money to spend, you want to make sure that that money is being spent in a way that makes you feel that you're contributing to the solution rather than being part of the problem, I think. And I think you see this all the way around. I mean, even the way people are eating, restaurants or street food, people want to understand the story behind it and feeling that you're putting back into your local community or whatever it is. Now, as I said, you can't ignore the fact that there are people who just don't have those choices at the moment because they are really running to stand still. But I think from the data, as you said, the data that's coming out now, it seems to be that that's a more common feeling across lots and lots of different segments of the population as well.
Indeed, yes. And I probably should have mentioned that it's all the caveats around how the data is polled, what the segmentation is and all of that kind of stuff. But yeah, I guess one of my final questions is, you mentioned this earlier, you're an organisation that's looking 20 years ahead, what do we need to be? And we live in this kind of age of exponential change. We've got change in technology, and also we've got the kind of, I don't want to call it a cliff edge, that's not the right terminology, but we've got the climate crisis that we need to do something about now. So could you talk a little bit about any kind of sense you have about what you need to look like in 20 years? Because that's really interesting.
I think that there will be a lot more around social sustainability, which is one of the reasons we've set up our new steering group, because I do think that there's increasingly a crossover. And inevitably, really, I mean, if you're going back to TCFD, if you're looking at your climate risks, and it's very difficult to look at those without thinking about the impact they will have on communities, and then you're talking about human trafficking or child labour. And so I notice actually I'm having a lot more conversations with colleagues in human rights organisations and development organisations about what that means to work together. And it's back to your question about sustainability. It can be a bit of a buzzword, but we have to be really clear about what we mean by social sustainability. To your point about great change and people being interested in perhaps sustainability careers, we have launched something last year called the Green Careers Hub. It's free. It's we've done it as part of our kind of public good bit of our space, and pretty much, you know, if you're upskilling, reskilling, skilling, whatever that is, there should be information there for you and on the sorts of careers that you can have. And we've talked about kind of quite middle class professionals' careers at the moment. We need 20,000 electricians to put in electric vehicle charging points. We need plumbers and ex-gas fitters to be able to support heat pumps and solar panels and we need doctors trained in climate, in the changes that the climate's going to bring. I was talking to a professor at Great Ormond Street who said they're already seeing a kind of different microbial family turning up because of the change in temperature, which is going to have an effect on the diseases we get, the infections we get, and what we need to do to combat them. So there is not a single part of the economy or society. First responders with electric vehicles, it's a very different protocol you need if there is a crash with an electric vehicle. Every single sector of the economy needs to think about how this is going to affect them.
Yeah, it does feel like we're in a time of kind of change and hopefully positive change as a society at the moment.
As I said, I think the really inspirational thing, and that was quite interesting, that talking to colleagues from environmental charities, for example, who were also at COP, they thought exactly the same thing. The really inspirational bits were coming from young people and were coming from business, who were just saying, right, we'll just do this now then, shall we?
I think the challenge is governments, because everything is moving so quickly, they're just not equipped to deal with it. But, you know, especially in tech where I work, like, they legislatively are so far behind.
Completely. And I don't think we can assume that government is there. I mean, you know, legislation in the past has always been to basically lift the bottom of the bar, really, to make sure that the minimum you need to be doing is this. To expect that government's going to be driving stuff, I think, in a complex marketplace. And as you said, you just can't keep up. With the best run in the world, you are not going to be able to keep up with what is happening in tech, because it seems to be changing every 48 hours, 72 hours. All you can do is maybe hope to have some guidelines, but then, as I said, keep raising the bottom rung. So you're making sure that the most people are doing what you would expect the minimum to be.
That's really, lots of things you wouldn't think about on the surface of it, but we'll definitely link to that hub in our kind of show notes if people are interested. And I guess, finally, just to say thank you so much for coming on. That was incredibly interesting. If people want to find out more about IEMEA, is it a case of going on the website? You've got a lot of information about membership and all the good work you do on there.
Absolutely. www.iema.net. We are in the middle of quite a big IT transformation at the moment. So it's great now. It'll look unbelievable in about 3 or 4 months' time. So watch this space. But yes, please do. And or drop us a line and give us a call if you're interested in finding out more.
Thanks so much to Sarah for coming on the show. I really hope you enjoyed that. What a kind of interesting and wide-ranging conversation. That's what I really enjoy about this, that, you know, we're not going surface level. We're really kind of digging into things and asking sometimes silly questions like, what the hell do we mean by sustainability? Anyway, so this episode forms a little bit of a mini series in the podcast where we are focusing on sustainability, net zero, what do we do about the climate crisis? So if that is something you are really interested in, I do recommend you go and check out a number of our recent episodes, and we've got more upcoming as well. So it is worth following us to get our latest updates of new episodes. And finally, if you enjoyed this, you could really do us a solid and leave a rating and or a review on the podcast platform of your choice. Honestly, it just helps us reach more people, you know, kind of amplify the content we're producing. And also it gives me some kind of feedback as well on how we're doing. And if there's anything in particular, you know, if there's a guest you want us to have on or a topic you want us to cover, feel free to reach out via email. You can get me personally on bethan@openvelocity.com. And with that, I will leave that there. Until the next time, hope you have a fantastic rest of your day, whatever you are doing.